Meow.
Freedom Fiends broadcasting from Pod Bay 2A, a mile above sea at Intair Studios. We alter your locus coeruleus by warming your synapses with rejuvenative radio waves. This warms your brain to a tasty and toasty 365 degrees Fahrenheit to keep a sin flood of statism out of your head. Can you feel it? Can you feel it? Is it working, Ben Stone and Chandler St. Pierre?
I feel it.
Woo-hoo.
I can feel it.
You can feel it? The Freedom Fiends is also covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except governments. Learn more at BIPCOT.org.
Cool.
So, Chandler, Ben,
yeah.
How's it going?
Good.
It's going.
Yeah.
It's going.
So it's great to be on the radio with you guys.
Yeah.
Summertime.
Always a pleasure. Summertime and
summertime
nice
on the
humid
radio.
Where I'm at.
That should be a song.
It should be a song. Nice. So, we were kind of talking before the show, and I wrote an article recently called Libertarian Fundamentalism. And I was wondering if you guys had read it and what your thoughts may be on it.
I just heard about it today and was just glancing at it. So explain it to me.
All right. So I'll give a brief summary here. So this is an article that's kind of been bouncing around in my brain for a while now. And what it does is it draws some parallels between certain tactics that libertarians use that are very similar to tactics that religious fundamentalists use. And I give the example of Christian fundamentalism, but I also state that it's any type of religious fundamentalism. There's a lot of overlap, in the tactics. And my case is basically pointing out the parallels and saying that maybe we shouldn't be using this kind of religious language to sell a philosophy.
You know,
so the parallels... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to real quick comment. You know, I have actually met more than one person that have said essentially that they viewed both like ANCAP thought and anarcho, market anarchy and libertarian thought as being very, very cult-like. And there really is a lot of parallels. A lot of the same wording is used, like exactly like you're saying.
Well, it's interesting because I was having a conversation with a friend the other day. And they were talking about my belief structure in reference to anarcho-capitalism and the government and all that. And they did. They said I sounded almost religious, which it kind of bothered me. I was like, wow, I didn't realize. I guess you really have to think carefully when you talk about that stuff because you can come off sounding like that even if you're not trying to.
Right. And I kind of take, I guess, a more panarchist approach to some of the philosophy. I still lean heavily libertarian. So the purpose in writing this article wasn't to poke fun at libertarians or try to say, you're doing everything wrong. It was to say, hey, I don't know that this is the best hack you have for liberty. So I guess we can go through some of the parallels I found with libertarian fundamentalists and other religious fundamentalists. So the first one I listed was they have their patron saints or sacred cows or benevolent leaders that you're not allowed to criticize. And these leaders rise to prominence. It's a very small movement. And a lot of times their fraudulent behavior is downplayed by people who are following them. And they end up getting away with some things. And where this comes from is an article I wrote back in December called Libertarian Welfare Queens. And it kind of pointed out some key figures in libertarianism that I thought were maybe not the best representatives for the philosophy. And I got some backlash from that. There were a lot of people who said, well, you're not really allowed to criticize these people because they've brought so many people into libertarianism, which sounds a lot like, oh, you're not allowed to criticize certain religious leaders because they've brought so many people into the flock.
Yeah, it makes sense.
What is this not allowed to thing? I mean, I thought the whole idea of anarchism was individualism and, you do what you want as long as you're not hurting anyone.
Right. Well, so yeah, and I mean, I said not allowed. I'm exaggerating a bit. I did get some positive feedback from the article too, but there was a very visceral reaction from a lot of people, kind of regarding the people that I chose to highlight in the article.
Do you think it's because they hold these people in such high esteem that if you challenge these leaders, you're challenging them?
I think it's possible. I think they're could be some projection there, because the people that I selected are very charismatic and have a lot of followers. And I think a lot of, well, no one really likes being told that someone they look up to is not maybe the best person ever. I think a lot of people experience this in their childhoods. For example, when you figure out that your parents are not perfect and maybe they're not telling you the whole truth about things, or in other authority structures too, maybe you realize that your teachers are wrong about something, and that is that can be very disillusioning for people.
Yeah.
And I think the same applies to any kind of leader that rises to prominence and has a lot of people following him or her.
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of times when I post articles on Twitter or Google Plus or Facebook, usually it's our circle of friends that'll be like, yeah, right on, you know. I posted an article about, what's the guy that sings in Pearl Jam, the lead singer?
Eddie Vedder.
Eddie Vedder, yeah. He made some really nasty statements about gun owners. And paraphrasing, basically, you know, they should be rounded up and shot. And, you know, I mean, I wrote a scathing post on the guy. I mean, I did call him a certain name. And all the responses I got back were so negative. Like, how dare it? And he was great, and I'm all for it. And he has the right to voice those absurd ideas. But I just don't agree with the fact that he wants me rounded up, you know, because I like guns and I own guns. I've never hurt anyone. And the vitriol that came around from people defending this guy for, I don't see how you could defend some of the things he said in that interview, but a lot of people did.
Right. And this is the problem with cult leaders, is they are sometimes it's pretty obvious that they're wrong from the outside. But when you're looking at things from the kind of inner circle or inner bubble, it can be hard to see. And it looks like these outsiders are just kind of making an attack on someone who you think may be doing a lot of good things.
Yeah.
You know, I was this was probably 3 or 4 years ago. I was on Facebook talking to a person who is the sister of a prominent name in the liberty movement that everybody would recognize, one of the most popular websites out there in our circle. And I was talking to her. It was a nice even chat, and I had said something about humans having not really being in touch with our here's the example. So like butterflies, when they're first born, as soon as they become butterflies, when they go through the metamorphosis, they have a knowledge, specifically monarch butterflies, know to leave Mexico, fly all the way to Canada, reproduce, and then fly all the way back to Mexico. Nobody teaches them that. They have it in their brains. And my argument was that humans have things like that in our brains, that society, by living the comfortable life that we live in modern society, we kind of push that stuff down and don't really hear it. And so this person, this sister of a very prominent person in the movement, corrected me and said, no, Mises, and this is a person who knew Mises personally, right? So she says, no, Mises said that it's like this and this and this. And I said, well, Mises was wrong. And there was such a level of anger about it that she called her big brother on me. Because I said, Mises was wrong. You know what? I can say Mises was wrong, because Mises was not God, and the world does not revolve around him, and he did not have everything exactly perfect. But I know what you're saying with that, because there are some people, even people who don't necessarily try to make, you know, cult-like followers that follow them around and worship their image, there are people that have just attained a certain level of respect in this thing of ours that we recognize, this whole liberty mess, that you can't say anything, you know, that disagrees with them publicly without, you know, getting some backlash for it.
Well, and I think, like, people have this strong aversion to being wrong. Everybody makes mistakes, and the idea is to learn from those mistakes and refine your thinking and your actions to get better. But I've noticed a lot of people, when they're confronted with wrong ideas or whatever, they deny it, and they're like, no, I'm not wrong, you're just not seeing it right, or whatever. And I think it's because they think if they have one bad idea or one bad viewpoint on something, they think it discredits everything else they believe, which is totally not true. But they resist that truth so much.
Yeah, everyone has their blind spots, and this is something I covered in the article because it's a mistake that I've made. I've been overly abrasive talking to people about some of these ideas, and I've used similar terminology and rhetoric that I end up criticizing in this article. So a lot of it is saying, hey, I was wrong, you know, and I'm looking to be corrected on tactics. And kind of the point of this is to just open up a discussion of tactics. It's not to say that, oh, everyone is wrong and this is the only right way to do something.
Hey, in case it's coming through.
Yeah, totally.
I'm dealing with a mower outside of my motorhome. For any new listeners that don't know, I live full-time as an RV person moving from campground to campground, and we happen to have a mower and a weed eater running outside, so I'm trying to ride the mute button on my mic to not let it come through as much as possible. Little interruption there. Go ahead.
All right. That's all right. It's all right. But yeah, this is kind of, you know, some lessons I've learned, and so I guess we'll keep going down the list. So one of the another thing I notice is sometimes I've heard people use terms like, oh, we need to outbreed the status. And I don't have a problem with people doing that, and I think that's great, and there are a lot of really awesome liberty parents out there. But it just reminds me of the Quiverful movement, if you all are familiar with that. It's the movement, it's a Christian fundamentalist movement. The Duggars, actually, the people with 19 children that have the show on TLC, they actually practice this. And
I don't know what that is.
Yeah, so it's about this Christian fundamentalist couple who has 19 children, and they're part of the Quiverful movement. Quiverfuls are wanting to have as many children as possible in order to spread their religion.
Okay, so 19 children. Are they still sane? I have one wonderful child, and I border on insanity. I can't imagine having 19 kids.
You and the hamster in your brain are listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and his weird friends.
Wake up and smell the freedom. One of the easiest things you can do to help Liberty is to torrent Freedom Fiends episodes to help keep them drone-proof. You can set up your home computer to download and share Freedom Fiends archives over BitTorrent. You can even set up scheduling so it only shares while you're asleep or at work. Put your unused computing power to work and help keep the Freedom Fiends around well into the future. Simply go to freedomfiends.com and click on the Torrent Club link and learn how to torrent and share Freedom Fiends archives.
Hey, this is Nathan Explosion from Death Clock, and you're listening to Freedom Fiends on the radio. Worms.
For some reason, in this country, and in a bunch of Western world, it's okay to just judge.
Hey, this is Michael Dean from the Freedom Fiends radio show. Computer programmer Derek Slopey and I have created FiendPhone. I'm using FiendPhone right now to talk with and record one of my co-hosts in real time. Take it, Davi.
Hey, this is Davi Barker, and I'm 1,000 miles away from Michael, but we sound like we're in the same room.
We sure do, Davi. So, Davi, please tell the nice people more about FiendPhone.
FiendPhone is free, no-gov software that opens up a global world of possibilities for collaborative, high-quality, remote voice media production, and I'm digging it.
People can try FiendPhone right now at FiendPhone.com, but we're also raising money to vastly improve FiendPhone and vastly improve independent talk media worldwide.
So go to FiendPhone.com to help out. Who will build the audio roads? We will, with your help.
That's FiendPhone.com, FiendPhone.com, Foxtrot, Echo, November, Phone.com.
FiendPhone, I never knew remote audio could be this good.
Meows and meows.
Worms everywhere.
Freedom Fiends on the radio. So we had a nice talk.
Yeah. So we were kind of, we left off talking about Quiverfuls and how they may be similar to some libertarians, which, you know, so libertarians sometimes will talk about outbreeding the status. And I was making the analogy that it sounds very similar to the Quiverful movement, which is a Christian fundamentalist movement to have as many children as possible, have these very large families to spread the good word to other people. And I'm all for liberty people having babies, by the way. This is not like anti-baby or anything like that. I'm just saying it doesn't work from a mathematical standpoint. Like, right. You're never going to outbreed the status because there's just too many of them. And that's okay. You know, that's okay. So, but using that kind of language, it doesn't really, I guess, make sense to me from a strategic standpoint.
Yeah, so. And also from an economic point of view, you know, the government, almost every government, massively subsidizes the reproduction of more and more people who depend on the government. I mean, there's, you know, that's what all the different welfare and socialist programs do. They literally reward the non-productive aspects of society who depend the most on government. It rewards them for making more kids. So how are you going to compete with that when there's a giant mechanism rewarding them to make more people?
Yes, and I think libertarians have a well enough understanding of incentives to get that.
I hope so.
Well, I don't know.
I hope so. Well, okay, so another thing on the list is people actually use the word convert when talking about convincing people that libertarianism is the correct philosophy. And like I've heard a lot of people say, oh, we have to convert status. We have to, you know, and that bothers me, not because I think you shouldn't be trying to have a dialogue with people who maybe even vehemently disagree with you on libertarianism, but it kind of puts people in this adversarial role. Like I don't, when I think of converting, it immediately has a religious connotation to me.
The Inquisition.
And I'm immediately, I'm like turned off by people who just every conversation has to be about trying to get me to believe their worldview. I've always had this problem, which is why I'm an anarchist. I don't like anyone trying to convert me to anything. And I don't really feel the need to convert people to my beliefs that much either. I mean, obviously, I write a lot about this stuff. It would be nice if we could find some common ground with, you know, some of these philosophies. But I don't really like to be evangelical about it.
What do you think about the idea of adaptation when it comes to spreading the message of liberty? I think, because I've found both conservatives and liberals, and I hate to use the two-sided coin or whatever, but they both think I'm crazy when I talk a lot of times, because I agree with some conservative principles and I agree with liberal principles. So I don't try to convert people, I just try to present them with ideas and hopefully they adapt their belief system to that.
Yeah, so you have to meet people where they are, not where you want them to be. And
right.
You have to know your audience. If you're talking to someone who's conservative, they're going to have some preconceived notions that you'll want to address. And same as with a Democrat. And I think it's very useful to try to find common ground and work from there. I am a bit of, I can be kind of adversarial and contrarian sometimes too. And sometimes that does
Can't
work.
We all?
Can't we all, right? Like, and sometimes that tactic does work. But a lot of times it can be very off-putting if you don't have the kind of, I guess, self-awareness to see how you may be coming across. And again, this is something I've been guilty of. I've been too abrasive before. And, you know, I don't want to say I necessarily regret that. But it's all pieces I was in.
Well, you know what I've found is a lot of times, and I hate to sound collectivist, but we in the libertarian circles tend to say that people of statists of, you know, conservative or liberal beliefs, all they do is believe what's on, you know, like Fox News or CNN, or, you know, they believe all the media hype, and that's where they get all their information, and they're not critical thinkers. But, you know, I've talked to many libertarians, and I guess it's the younger ones and the newer ones, but they're kind of the same. They have their canon that they follow, and they can't adapt to it, and they can't critically think as well.
Yeah, that leads right to the next point in the article, so we'll pick it up right after the break.
Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean. This is what radio sounds like now.
When you shop online, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you any extra, and the fiends will get a little taste from Amazon, and Amazon will save you the danger of drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon sells pretty much everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom. So get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com. Freedom, Foxtrot, Echo, Echo, November, Sierra.com.
Hey, this is Squisklar Squig Elves from Death Clocks. And you are listening to the Freedoms Fiends on the, you know, the radios. And I guess it says worms now. So there you go.
Tired of those old Freedom Fiends buttons? Well, the Freedom Fiends have new button designs.
As always, it's only $10 for 10 buttons, and you'll get these nifty designs. Buy sheep, for sheep, on sheep.
State speech is hate speech.
Two designs for Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom.
Three designs for Fiend Phone.
Pipcot No Gov.
A Freedom Fiends Worms button.
And Ask Me About My Worms.
Go to freedomfiends.com and click on the link at the top that says Buttons.
And now they're bigger buttons.
They used to be 1¼ inch. Now they're 1¾ inch. Dan, they're bigger buttons.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
I think I hear a real cat in the background meowing.
So,
Freedom Fiends.
What was that next point in the list?
Chandler actually set it up for me. Before the break, we were talking about people who believe anything that they see on television and just, you know, uncritically accept it. And it turns out libertarians do the same thing in some ways. So we were talking about trying to convert people to libertarianism. And another problem I have with some of the libertarian fundamentalist tactics are calling people things like sheeple to imply that they're not awake and that they don't have critical thinking when it comes to taking in relevant information. And Chandler was saying that he's noticed that among a lot of libertarians, that, and I have too, this idea that because the government has lied to us so much, and because, you know, there are so many corrupt organizations, that it's hard, you can't trust any mainstream media, and maybe they only uncritically accept what other organization, like alternative media, puts out there that may not be very well researched and maybe a lot of opinion. And what this reminds me of is the kind of saved and lost dichotomy of Christian fundamentalism, which everyone, you know, if you have God within you, you're a saved person, and everyone else is lost. So libertarians have their own version where, you know, you've been woken up, you've taken the red pill, and everyone else is a sheeple. And that's very adversarial, and
it's kind of conceited too.
It's super conceited.
You know,
it's super conceited.
I'm not
fully realize that.
Go ahead, Chandler.
Go ahead, Ben.
Go ahead, Chandler.
You first. I'll wait. Okay. I was going to say, I really only noticed that when I started to take a look at myself, because I found myself doing that. I found myself you know, just following and quoting, you know, books and speakers that I had thought had the right idea and admired. And I was like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I'm not putting my own adaptation on this. And then I started to look around. And I was like, wow, I think we all have a lot of work to do with that.
Mm. Oh, and this is also, you know, a way of me admitting that I've done the same thing. You know, I backlashed into only alternative media stuff and was just like, oh, you can't trust anything that the mainstream media says. And that's not a very balanced position to take.
No, I think a lot of us, we have a hard, well, I will say I have a hard time like reading, you know, viewpoints from the people I consider wrong, or watching, you know, the Fox News or whatever. It is very hard, and sometimes in the past I've been like, wow, you know, if I consume that media, it'll corrupt me. And it's like, no, you got to analyze it and look for the flaws if you want to make your case stronger. But for a long time, I think I was afraid to.
I kind of get irritated. I still try to look every now and then, but it kind of irritates me because I see the tricks that they're pulling. On the other hand, if you don't look and if you don't see, then you know, you're not really accustomed to what the con job looks like. So I think it does take a balance, and you are going to have some things that are coming from the mainstream media. You know, they're going to, their tendency to cover things right away. Sometimes they'll slip and put the truth out in the first message that they give, and then come back and fix it and make it fix their agenda afterwards. But a lot of times, the initial reporting on something is good.
Yes. You know, one book that I don't see recommended as much as I think it should be, and it kind of surprises me, but I really, really think The Art of War by Sun Tzu is a good book that everyone should read.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you know, somebody turned me on to that in middle school, and I read it, and then I recently, you know, got a copy a couple of years ago and reread it. And I think it's just such a great, I don't know, I wouldn't even call it a battle plan. It's just, it's a great way to adapt your thinking.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't see that book recommended as much.
You know, something I was thinking about a minute ago when, MK, when you were talking about conversion, using that terminology, conversion. You know, I've seen a lot of people, and this is true among Christians as well, because I've spent a lot of time in churches and Christian churches and around Christians. And I see very often that, and it's not universal, I'm not drawing a hard line and saying it's always this way, but just sometimes you see, you know, somebody who's extremely enthusiastic about Christianity, and they go out and they talk to their friends or their family or whatever, and they convince them intellectually that, you know, and they get that conversion intellectually. And the person might start coming to church for a week or two or a month or maybe even a year, but deep down inside, they haven't really changed. And very often, they will go back to whatever the self-destructive behavior or whatever it was that they were trying to look for an answer for before. They'll go back to that because they never really had a grasp on what it was that enthusiastic Christian was trying to tell them. And I think I see the same thing with libertarian thought, where somebody is around a libertarian, either professionally or whatever, and or they hear the buzz. You know, it's kind of cool and hip right now to be a libertarian. We're the cool cats on the block right now. But, you know, this brings in a lot of people who just want to use the terminology, just want to be one of the cool cats, use the golden black flag on their, you know, on their social media identity. And they don't really get it. They've never had any one-on-one contact with police that have really put it down deep in their soul that the police, that this whole process of what they call justice is evil. They've never experienced it, so it's all theoretical. And I think their so-called conversion is also theoretical. And very often I look at some of these people who have the right terminology, but yet they don't really know, you know, you can tell it's not deep set inside them. They don't have that screaming desire inside them to be free. And I just wonder, you know, are they, what's really their level of, if to use that terminology, what's their real level of conversion? Is it just that, you know, we're the kids with the cool black boots right now, and they want to have black boots because they want to be cool kids?
So yeah, I don't think you may not like, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't think they've internalized it. I mean, when we were having the discussion at Porkfest on the panel, afterwards we talked, and, you know, some of the most profound, faithful people that I've seen are people that don't preach. They just, they've internalized these beliefs, and they live them through their actions. And I think a lot of those people you're talking about, Ben, haven't quite internalized all these ideas yet.
Yeah, and so that kind of leads into the very next thing in the article, which I criticize, and I don't know, Ben may disagree with this, but I think it is problematic to say that people who, for instance, maybe they identify as libertarian, but then end up changing their minds later, a lot of libertarians might say, oh, well, they were never libertarian enough to begin with. And what this is similar to in Christian fundamentalism is when people backslide or convert away from the faith, they'll make excuses like, oh, well, they were never a true believer to begin with. And what my problem with this is that it leads to purity tests and calls for purges and kind of witch hunts, for example. Oh, the left libertarians are destroying everything, or the right libertarians aren't real libertarians. So I guess I have a problem with, I guess, purity tests for libertarianism that are a little too strict. It's okay to have principles, and obviously someone who is advocating that we need more defense spending probably does not get libertarianism. But I think we have to take people seriously if they say that they identify as that, and then, you know, definitely ask some follow-up questions to see that they really get the philosophy.
I think taking
But sometimes people do have valid reasons for moving away from libertarianism. I may not understand them, but I'm also not going to downplay the validity of those reasons.
I think, using back to the Christian metaphor there, I think that's kind of why I'm a Quaker rather than, you know, I was raised a Baptist and I was around a lot of different evangelical churches and all kinds of different things as I was growing up and in my early 20s and stuff. And I think it's why I settled into Quakerism is because no one Quaker has the authority to point his finger at another person and say, you're not a Quaker because you don't do A, B, and C. And I think that's, and I'm, you know, I'm probably guilty of this as much as anybody with libertarian ideas, but I think that, you know, and the distinction with Quakerism is, if you don't like what that guy's saying, don't hang out with him. And it's that simple. Or, you know, hang out with him, use yourself as an example, not in your words, but in your life, and have your life as the example and shut your stinking mouth. And oftentimes, that is a much bigger, using the Christian metaphor again, that's a much bigger witness as a Quaker for me, is living your life and not nagging at the other person rather than having your mouth flapping all the time and just driving them insane with all your Christian nonsense that you keep spouting. You know, I'm saying that from my I'm not attacking anybody else's faith. I'm saying, you know,
compare libertarian. Oh, sorry, there was a dropout there. I thought you were
done. Go ahead.
But yes, that's a really good point, and that's why I was very careful to compare libertarian fundamentalists to Christian fundamentalists and other religious fundamentalists, because it tends to be those people who are the most outspoken and abrasive and judgmental, and it definitely doesn't apply to more moderate religious people at all.
Yeah.
And I think, again, same with you know, libertarians are moderate libertarians. And maybe they don't pass some of these purity tests that a lot of the more hardcore people want to hold them to. But I don't think, I think libertarianism is a much broader philosophy than definitely anarcho-capitalism. Both of those things are very specific. Anarchism, too, is much broader than anarcho-capitalism. So that's why I did kind of, I was speaking somewhat broadly with libertarianism.
Well, you know, one of the things I don't understand, like, you could be as hardcore as you want and as principled as you want on your flavor of anarchism and libertarianism. But what right do you have to criticize and complain about other people? You know, I thought it was an all an individual thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I vehemently disagree with lots of people every day. And oh well, you know, as long as they're not interfering with my life, who am I to say anything?
But we can still mock them, right?
Well, we can mock them and have fun with it, but at the end of the day, I mean, where does it lead? You know, I mean, it just, you're not going to win any friends that way. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Worms.
Stick with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Freedom Fiends, an invigorating alternative to those other shows.
Are you sick of government lackeys who say, "You didn't build that"? Are you tired of elitists like Barack Obama and Al Gore taking credit for the web while trying to take over the web? Are you disgusted by experts whose concept of the internet is that it's a series of tubes? Take back the free market of computing by encouraging software developers to adopt the BIPCOT NoGov license. The BIPCOT NoGov license allows any use or modification except by governments. Go to BIPCOT.org. That's Bravo, India, Papa, Charlie, Oscar, Tango.org.
Which is like beans, but fiends is better. I don't know. Beans are pretty good, too.
Yes. Fiends is better.
A bowl full of worms. Fiend.
A bowl full of
beans, fiends. All right. So, just going to wrap this up. This is an article I wrote on my personal blog. You can view it at mklords.wordpress.com. And basically, it's comparing libertarian fundamentalists to other religious fundamentalists. And a couple other bullet points I'll just quickly go through is another trait is this paralyzing fear of this invisible but influential specter marauding and causing all these bad things. In Christian fundamentalism, it's Satan. In libertarian fundamentalism, it's the state. And
aren't they the same
sometimes
thing?
Well, right, but to kind of further that point, they'll sometimes make the state the very worst thing and responsible for everything while also downplaying other factors like, hey, maybe there's just some bad people out there, including business owners and, you know, and stuff like that. And then let's see, there are remnants and sellouts, a lot of crash and the EMPs, and they're going to get us all. And maybe economically we're not in the best shape, obviously, but I don't think that the world is going to be coming to an end every couple months, like some people try to say. And then there's mantras, too. We have our own mantras and our own sayings, some of which I really like. And but the general point is I didn't really get into this philosophy because I wanted a worldview that fit everything neatly into boxes and made people into these objects that needed to be molded into something. I have the same problems with other types of fundamentalism because it reduces people into conquests. It pits the holy against the sinful. It creates idols who repeatedly get away with fraud because they spread the good word a few times. And it lacks nuance and empathy. And it's just unnecessary, too. There's no reason to use religious terminology for something that can be argued rationally and compassionately.
Amen.
That's a rational and logical argument.
Thank you. that's kind of the summary. And, you know, the religious charlatanism, it works tactically in a lot of ways, but it kind of rubs me the wrong way.
I find it interesting that there's many anarcho-libertarians, whatever you want to call them, out there that are they're atheists. And they'll be the first ones to bag on you if you have some sort of religious faith. Yet, like you've pointed out in this article, they're also the first ones to use those fundamentalist tactics. And I don't even think they see that.
And that was the critique. And this was directed at libertarian atheists more so, by the way. Yeah. I have a paragraph in there saying, if you're a religious, if you do practice religion as an anarchist or libertarian, then it probably makes sense to use these tactics. But these vehement atheists, they end up sounding like religious zealots. And that's kind of the great irony of the libertarian fundamentalism.
Well, I think atheism is a religion just like any other religion, honestly. And it all depends on how the individual handles it.
It is kind of messed up, though.
I think some people can be religious about it.
It is kind of messed up, though, that some... I mean, if you look at religion and you specifically, in your thinking, you know, avoid Catholicism because that's kind of an outlier, and let's say Mormonism and a couple of the others that what I'm about to say doesn't apply to, but mostly fundamentalist Christianity, you get a lot of these really spectacular personalities that have over-the-top ministries, and they're generally on TV. They have huge mega churches of tens of thousands of people following them and all giving them money and everything. And we that are liberty-minded people kind of have a tendency to do that exact same thing. We pick out these people, just like people in the evangelical Christians or you know, other fundamentalist Christians. And we kind of do the same thing. That's what you were referring to in the beginning of that article. And it's really sad because very often when, as far as like, you know, televangelists and stuff, when those people crash, they crash hard and big. And yet their followers will not recognize, you know, what it is that just took place. They will still follow them. They'll still send them money. They'll still, you know, deify them practically. It's sad.
Right. And it is really sad, and that does happen with libertarianism. And I think, again, one of my biggest problems with this is this idea that people need to be saved in the first place, you know, that statists need to be converted in the first place. Maybe they have some blind spots, but so does everyone else. And, you know, I don't think they're headed towards damnation just because they believe the government maybe has a role. Or should have a role in some places, but
stick with us. We'll be right back after this, after the news break.
Are you tired of your taxes funding endless occupations around the world? Antiwar.com is run by people who understand that wars abroad become wars at home, wars on our freedoms. Antiwar.com is dedicated to bringing you the latest in news, views, interviews, and reviews from the top movers and shakers in the anti-occupation movement. Antiwar.com has it all, from thorough foreign policy analysis to interviews with whistleblowers who used to run the military-industrial complex. Anti-war, pro-free market. That's Antiwar.com.
This is the Freedom Fiends. We've hijacked the CIA's orbital mind control laser to beam the pirate signal of protest directly into your frontal cortex and tell you that you are free. And we should mention that the Freedom Fiends is covered by a BIPCOT no government license. This allows reuse by anyone except
the evil government.
Governments.
Do we lose Chandler?
Yes.
Ah, there he is.
And you can learn more at bipcot.org.
Worms.
Yeah.
So the last hour, because there's some radio stations that only carry us for 1 hour. They carry the second hour, some carry both hours, some carry the first hour. So if you're listening on a radio station that only carries the second hour, you missed in the first hour. MK was talking about an article that she wrote, and we'll put a link in today's show notes. So if you missed that, go to freedomfiends.com and look in today's show notes, and you can find the link that goes to MK's article that she wrote about that. And you can also download the show and listen to it in its entirety there, rather than, you know, fighting with your local radio station, pounding on their door. They really don't like that when Freedom Fiends fans go down and pound on their door and demand more Freedom Fiends. They just don't get the humor in that. I don't understand.
Me neither.
Weird.
Especially when Freedom Fiends fans do that at 3 o'clock in the morning at the radio station. They just, I don't know. I don't understand. No sense of humor at all.
Hey, man, not my circus, not my monkeys.
Yep.
So something I wanted to talk about, and this came up because I had a wonderful opportunity to visit with Nima Vedati. Nima and his family came to our campground, and we hung out for a couple days. We got to go down, hang around on the shoreline, and you know, watch the birds and the fishes and the crabs crawling around in the rocks and all kinds of cool things. And something that Nima and I were talking about was that humans are problem solvers. And everybody has like this thing that they say, well, this is what separates us from the animals or whatever. And there's always a list of these different things that people talk about. But humans are real. One of the things that really stands out about humans is that we're problem solvers. And so much so that if you think about it, pretty much any game that you play, like a computer game or a card game that you play by yourself, is a problem-solving thing. If you sit down and you try to figure out a crossword puzzle or any kind of word game, you know, that you get, you buy those books with the little word games in them, all that stuff is a human being entertained by solving problems. And humans love to solve problems. It's kind of one of the reasons why humans talk to each other, because we share our problems with each other and then we try to solve our, you know, solve each other's problems. And it's kind of one of the reasons that humans can be nags with each other, because we're constantly trying to solve somebody else's problem by sticking our nose in their business. But
yes.
But so in my notes, I was talking, I put in here, after talking to Nima, I got to digging back through my old notes, and I almost did a podcast a couple years ago on this topic, and so I had some notes on it. And in thinking about this, I thought, you know, that's really goes back to the earliest stages of humanity in the Paleolithic age. Paleolithic meaning old Stone Age or early Stone Age. And we're talking about people who literally were facing all the aspects of nature without any of the stuff that we have with us today. And physically speaking, they had, you know, essentially the same skin as we have, the same hair quantities as we have, slightly hairier in northern regions, slightly less in southern regions. But essentially, they were the same creatures as we are now. They were that during the Paleolithic age. And so, you know, you imagine yourself, if you were instantly dropped way out in the middle of the forest, way out in the middle of nowhere, on your own, with nothing but basic rock tools and some basic equipment. And what would life be like if you were in a situation like that? And, you know, a human, as compared to all the other animals, has a whole series of disadvantages that other animals don't face. So, for instance, humans are slow comparative to predators. Humans are weak. We are soft-skinned. We don't have a shell. We don't have any of the nice stuff that, you know, that we don't have, like a turtle has a shell, and other animals have other kinds of protection in their skin. We don't have any of that. We lack climbing skills. Now, we can climb to a certain extent, but, you know, not like a monkey can climb or not like a squirrel can climb. So we lack climbing skills. We lack claws. We don't have claws on our hands. So we can't really defend ourselves in the way that a clawed animal can. We lack fighting teeth. Our teeth are not suited for defensive purposes. Our teeth are made for digestive purposes, but they're not really all that good for fighting. And so in addition to all that, a predator that might be stalking a human is going to have far superior hearing skills than we have, and they're going to have a further developed olfactory system than we have. So like the predator could smell us, but we can't smell the predator. So in a natural setting, we have all these things going against us. We don't have the kind of eyesight that some birds have. We don't have, you know, a lot of the things of the animals that we compete with in nature. We don't have those advantages. So in facing a problem like that, you're dumped in the woods. If you're dumped in the woods and you're naked or half naked and you got nothing but rocks to use as tools to defend yourself with and to make other tools with and so forth, you're going to have some serious problems that you're going to face. And so Paleolithic man faced exactly that. And so he had to rely on what his and you know what, there's some other problems too. There's a problem in human reproductive in the human reproductive system. Human offspring are helpless for years. You have to have, you have to completely take care of them. You have to feed them. You have to protect them. You have to nurture them. You have to train them to even be able, for them to be able to feed themselves, you have to train them to do that. They don't naturally, a baby human is not like a deer. A baby deer is born, and as soon as he can get on his feet, he can run. He can, you know, at least do something to defend himself. But a human is pretty much defenseless for years. And then we have the problem of aging. A human, by the time they get to be about 40 or 45, 50 years old, they start to break down. Their body starts to break down. And so we have this disadvantage to other animals, that we have to take care of our aged humans. We take care of the humans that are getting up there in their years. So we have these problems. Now, one of the first things that humans did to solve these problems was humans domesticated dogs. It's one of the very first things that humans did back in the time frame when we were still forming, you know, tools out of rocks and tools out of bones and tools out of wood. We were domesticating dogs. And the one of the main reasons that dogs literally allowed us to be civilized human beings is that they have the olfactory system that we don't have, so we can rely on their nose instead of relying on our own. They can smell that predator coming and warn us of it. They have better hearing than we have. They also have no fear. A dog has no fear of a big animal. A dog has such a commitment to his family, to his pack, that he sees it as his pack, that a dog will immediately go and sacrifice his life for the owners, for the people that own him. So domesticating a dog was one of the very first things that humans did to solve these problems that nature presented to us. And some other things that and I wanted to go through the advantages that humans have. First off, we have stereo vision. So we don't have the best vision. There are birds and some other animals that have better vision than we have, but we have stereo vision. And so by having stereo vision, this allows us to have a depth of field to about 100 yards. Now, when you get beyond about 100 yards, you don't have good depth of field, and you can't really see, you can't tell distances very good after about 100 yards. But 100 yards is good in the sense that if you're out in a field, if there's an animal that's coming at you within 100 yards, a predator, then you can do something about it. You can spot him. You can see the color definition. You can see the depth. You can see his movements and everything. So we have this really good stereo vision that has a good depth of vision for a depth of field for about 100 yards, and that gives us an advantage in an open field over a predator. Another thing is we have high dexterity hands with articulating fingers and opposable thumbs. Now, this is a huge advantage for humans. We also have instinctual family loyalty, and that has essentially saved us through eons of time and brought us down to where we are. We also have complex communication skills that allow the elderly to pass on wisdom to the young. And we have superior problem-solving brain. So what we lack in the physical aspects, we make up for in the fact that we have these advantages of depth of field in about 100 yards with good color definition, high dexterity fingers and hands with articulating fingers and opposable thumbs, and instinctual family loyalty and complex communication skills that allow the elderly to pass that wisdom down to the young. And when you take all these things together and then you realize that humans actually have fun solving problems, then you've got a creature that has a pretty good chance of surviving. And that's what we have.
Yeah.
It's so, one of my favorite.
I rambled on way too long there anyway.
Well, so one of my favorite things that separates humans from animals is our ability to have empathy with each other, and this aids in the problem solving. I think there's a direct connection because we want to make the world better for the people around us and the people that we love and care about. We have that capacity to understand their struggles and understand them on that very deep emotional level. So, of course, it makes sense that we want to solve the problems that cause us suffering.
Do you think that I would agree with with the statement that we humans view problem solving as fun. I can think back to when we were talking about how my basement was flooding. And I worked and worked and came up with a kind of makeshift system to prevent that. And there have been a lot of things around the house, you know, trying to figure out how things work and fix them so they work properly. But do you think it also has to do with drive as well as being fun? You have this certain drive to solve these problems and to
I think
improve.
So. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Stick with us. We're going to run away to the market, but we'll be right back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends. So much truth, it hurts. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. Basic Handgun and Rifle with Jared Waltz.
First rule of being alive is you own yourself.
A groundbreaking approach to firearms and self-defense training. Beautifully filmed and easy to understand instructions make this one a must-have. Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle, Volume 1. New DVD from Michael W. Dean, available on Amazon.
Your house is your property.
The Michigan Peace and Liberty Coalition is proud to present the 3rd Annual Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. It will be held at the Circle Pine Center in Delton, Michigan from August 7th through the 10th. There will be vending, discussions, presentations, all sorts of activities for children and adults, and bacon, lots of bacon. Round up your friends and family and get them registered today at miplc.org. That's miplc.org. Dogs welcome. Longer leashes recommended.
Meow.
So yeah, during the break, I was mentioning to you guys, there's a movie called The Edge, and it stars Alec Baldwin and Anthony Hopkins, who is one of my favorite actors. And the premise of the movie is Anthony Hopkins plays a millionaire, and in the beginning of the movie, his secretary gives him this old school small book, you know, survival, wilderness survival tips or whatever, and you know, he doesn't think much of it. So they're going out to this camp in the wilds of northern Alaska. And they go out there and do some stuff. And they go on a plane ride. And it's Anthony Hopkins and his assistant, who is played by Alec Baldwin. And he's a bad guy, of course. And another guy. And the plane crashes. And they're basically stuck in the northern wilds of Alaska. And they have to make their way back to the camp. And some of the stuff this guy comes up with, the millionaire guy, he's brilliant. And, you know, common survival things. And when you were talking about how humans have a substandard olfactory system compared to wild animals, I remember in one part of the movie, one of the guys had broken his leg and, you know, bones were sticking out and whatever. And they wrapped it up. And when they made camp at night, the millionaire character, here covered in blood, they'll attract grizzly bears. And the other guy didn't pay any attention, just thought he was blowing smoke. And he didn't bury him. And sure enough, out comes a grizzly bear. But the movie is great. You know, there's a whole sub-story underneath the survival aspect of it, which gives it a little added drama. But I would highly, highly recommend checking that out. It's The Edge. It's an older movie. I think it came out in the late 90s.
I like Anthony Hopkins.
Is this something I'd like to know more about?
And, you know, it's funny because Anthony Hopkins is the geriatric character, and he is definitely the survivor. Like, without him, I don't think those people would have made it back.
So, go ahead, MK.
I'd like to know more about survival.
Haven't been real?
No.
It's a card game. Oh, it's great. I have it. It's a card game, and it's basically you draw these cards. What would you do if? And it has all these worst case scenarios: car crashes, wilderness, you know, being stranded in the wilderness, all this stuff. And you know, you basically try to come up with a solution. And they have answers, like the given answers. So you actually learn a lot too. But it's a really fun game.
What was the name of it?
I don't know how you win. I think you just learn. Worst case scenario. It comes in a big yellow box.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a great game.
Now, the reason I brought that up about humans being problem solvers is, you know, we were talking about not harping too much in the last hour. We were talking about not harping too much on the state as the evil of all, you know, the be all end all of evil, and that every human thing that goes wrong is because of the state or whatever. But also, you want to keep in mind that humanity, without getting into the argument of how old is the earth and how old is humanity and all that kind of thing, but humanity is really old. And if you really look at the hard physical evidence, and don't let yourself get distracted by emotions and everything else, or, you know, humans have not really changed in a really long time. And in that extremely long period of time, the humans have essentially been exactly like they are now. The state has only been around, governments have only been around a very small wink of that time. Now, there's always been some form of leadership. There's always been, you know, families have leadership, natural leaders that are in families. A clan together might have natural leadership. But as far as a government that's really... like we recognize government today, that's only been around a very short period of time. So really and truly, government is the odd man out in the relationship of humanity. If you think about it, the problem of there being government, of there being a group of predator humans that live off of all the other humans, or not really even predator humans, although there are some of those too, but the problem of there being parasitic humans that live off of other humans, that's really what the government is. It's a group of predators and parasites that live off the rest of humans, of humanity. So if you realize that this is just a problem that people face, and you realize that we have faced much bigger problems over the eons of time, you know, a giant weather change like what happened during the Ice Ages is a much bigger deal than the government. But we survived that, and actually humanity thrived during the last Ice Age. There's quite a bit of evidence of that, that the population actually exploded, and humans were pretty successful. So this is kind of an upbeat thing. If the biggest problem that we face today is the government, that's just a problem. We can fix that.
So this reminds...
You're listening to the Freedom Fiends, and I'm beaming these words into your cerebellum.
My fellow sheep, election season is upon us. Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan flock of sheep whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? By only voting for candidates dedicated to expanding government. It's easy. You don't need to study the issues. No matter what a politician says when running for office, they're all dedicated to expanding government. And make sure you tell all your friends and family to vote for more government. Here at CATMUF, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. CATMUF. Because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
So during the break, Chandler had an interesting thing to say. So,
I was thinking during the last segment, you know, all this talk about how the government is such a little problem that humanity faces, and we face so much more, and it just reminded me of the Grateful Dead song, Touch of Grey, you know, the chorus, "We will survive." And I think that's totally true. Humans, if anything, they are persistent.
Yeah.
So this reminds me of a conversation I had with a listener of the show, Carlos Morales. We were talking about this pretty similar topic, how humans are able to endure, and he used the analogy that humans are anti-fragile, which is used in technology a lot to describe something that benefits from shocks, and it thrives and grows when it's exposed to volatility and stress. And this is very true for humans who've undergone very traumatic things. I mean, there are people who have survived just incredible trauma and are stronger for it. Now, a lot of times this trauma can, you know, break someone down, and sometimes they are unable to recover. But I do think there's a strong case to be made that as you go through life and you experience these hardships, you do get stronger over time and you get better at dealing with the problems that are going to come your way.
You know, it's interesting. I work in the mental health field, and I would find that statement true, and the only time I would disagree with that is when you have the systems of society and oftentimes governments that try to help. That's what gets in the way of making a person survive and get stronger from trauma. Left to their own devices and their natural support systems from friends and family, yes, they will get stronger. It's only when those governmental interfere that it doesn't work.
Yeah, and we were talking about this in the context of trigger warnings, which are warnings that are placed on content that might be disturbing to people who have gone through a traumatic event. And we're saying, well, the intentions behind trigger warnings are definitely good. What they end up doing is shielding someone from something that could end up making them stronger. And there's a lot of research that also suggests that confronting these triggers and confronting these very bad feelings from these traumatic events actually helps you persevere through them better. So the intentions of trigger warnings are good, but the outcomes are not always good. And it kind of is very counterintuitive.
I have a real problem with the trigger warnings and the sheltering. I mean, maybe it's the cynic in me, but it seems to me that we've made, especially the younger generations. I can't say the word on the air that I'm thinking, but we've sheltered them.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, because humans are. I mean, they've survived much worse things than what there may even be trigger warnings for nowadays. I mean, the trigger warnings are mostly used at the college level, which should be a place that challenges you and makes you uncomfortable about your already held beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, when I used to work in the crisis center, some of the things I saw people come in for, you know, there was definitely people coming in with real trauma, with real problems. But there were people that were coming in, and I just wanted to be like, really? You know, can you just grow a set and deal with it?
Come on,
yeah,
Nancy.
That's pretty much, and you know, you can't say that as a mental health professional, but man, God, I had to bite my
tongue. Yeah, and I mean, like, I was going to say, like, I've experienced being able to confront those things directly and work through them. And it is a very uncomfortable experience. That's not to downplay the emotional trauma of being triggered, because it's very, very uncomfortable.
But it's key what you said. It forces you to confront it and address it and deal with it. And I think that's where a lot of society goes wrong. We just try to avoid.
Right. You try to protect people from themselves. And that's very paternalistic.
So we're
not problem solving.
We're not just telling people spray some Bactine on it and get back in the game, Nancy. But we're saying we do need.
No, it's super glue, man.
Yeah, there you go. Super glue that cut back together and throw him back in the ring.
Yep.
But it is true to a large extent. You know, you get better the more you handle these things, and the better you get, and the stronger you get, and the more you're able to deal with a situation. I think about when I was young. And I guess it was because I was injured pretty bad so many different times, or maybe not really bad, but I was injured, you know, bad enough to have stitches or have to go to the hospital and get a broken bone fixed or whatever. And it got me to the point of where when I was in my early 20s, I was on a rescue squad, and I saw some pretty bad things that would cause most average people to kind of lock up. But I was able to just work right through it because, you know, I had already had a lot of pretty bad things happen to me. And so I was able to, in spite of the gore of what I was looking at, to go ahead and do my job and help the person out of the situation and you know, and try to make things better.
Do you find that in situations like that, you sort of compartmentalize everything and deal with the immediate threat. You know, you prioritize and task and just deal with it and get it done and then take it from there.
Yeah, and I don't know if that was because we were trained to do that. That's part of triage training. And I don't know if it was, you know, natural to me or if I just, you know, recognized that training as being good and just immediately followed through with it.
I think, yeah, you know, I and I don't want to sound like an old curmudgeon, but, you know, I grew up and I spent a lot of time with my grandmother and that older generation. And I think, you know, these are people that grew up in the Depression.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of instinct was more natural. They may have not had triage training and that sort of thing, but they just, it came naturally. And I see in a lot of, even my generation and the younger generation, that natural instinct has been diminished. And I think that's what we need to work towards getting back.
Yeah, and I found, and I don't know if this is just because of this sort of things that I experienced in my life, but in stressful situations, I go into this mode where I'm somehow able to be really calm and, you know, figure out kind of what needs to be done. And then I don't get that kind of emotional burst until afterwards. I have kind of like this delayed emotional response. Or even in like less serious situations, you know, where I read something that should be offensive or what have you, and, you know, I'll be able to read it and kind of think about it. Or someone says something to me that's offensive. I don't know. It does. I don't get an immediate reaction. I'll have like a delayed like anger response. Like afterwards, I'll be like fuming about it, you know?
Yeah. Well, I know in my line of work, we study the crisis cycle. And I think that's really, it's really beneficial to anyone. I mean, you have like, it goes escalation, crisis, de-escalation, and post-crisis. And in between each of those steps, you have, you know, like thinking and logical, abstract thought is diminished and that sort of thing. And I think if you learn that crisis cycle, you can learn how to deal with people better. You know, because there are all sorts of different crises. What you may not consider a crisis, other people may. And, you know, sometimes you don't see that when you're talking to them or you're interacting with them.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, this is where the kind of empathy comes in, too, because people do deal with stress differently.
Yeah.
Yep.
Very much so.
I just go out in the woods. That's the best thing. You know, I read this.
Yeah, there you go.
I posted this article, and it was like some scientific study that, you know, taking a walk in the woods helps reduce stress and anxiety and recharge you. And I was like, yeah, that's great. But I didn't need to spend $25,000 on a study to know that. I've been doing that since I was a kid.
Yes. Oh, man. I want to go back to Porkfest already, go back into the woods.
And, yeah. Well, I've got a nice place. About 15 minutes away from me. We call it Hobbit Land. I think it's called Vaughn's Woods officially, but, you know, it's a nature trail or whatever. Lots of waterfalls and stone bridges and foresty area, and it's just so great, you know. I'll go out there and just kind of sit back and recharge. You know, I try not to take the electronics with me. I used to do that at first, you know, take the iPod or the Kindle or whatever and just sit out there and listen to music or read. But I found lately just going out there and walking and listening to the natural sounds, it helps.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I love unplugging for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good to do that.
That's the best. That's the best. Because we still have that kind of monkey brain part of us that reacts to stress. And, you know, now we live in the digital age where, you know, maybe we're reading a lot of stuff online and that's triggering a lot of our kind of adrenaline reactions and stuff like that that would normally be reserved for maybe life or death scenarios. People will get that fight or flight response from just reading an article on the internet now and not being chased by a bear, and it can kind of burn you out.
Yeah, people will fire off on just a Twitter, you know, 140 characters, and they are into fight or flight mode. They're ready to, you know, burn a house down over it, practically.
Yeah. Awesome. One of my Facebook friends was like, yeah, it's 5 a.m. and I'm already all worked up with all these people, and I'm like, dude, I get that you're trying to, like, you know, spread your message of liberty and everything, but just if you're getting that worked up at 5 a.m., maybe you need to like step off the internet for a while and just not engage these people, you know, do yes. something fun, do something to better your own life, you know, go mow your lawn or something. I don't know.
I think that kind of goes right, back to what Megan right. was saying in the first hour where, you know, there seems to be this almost religious fervor that we have to get out there. We have to knock on people's doors. We have to convince them, read our pamphlet. We have to get them into our church building and have them become one of us. And it's really, that's not what liberty is about. It's really more...
I don't know about you guys, but that fervor lasted about 3 months for me, and then I was done. I mean, right. I had it. I was I totally guilty.
I did catch it. I had
that.
It too.
But yeah, it didn't last long.
But oftentimes, that's more yes. annoying, you know, because it's. Yeah.
Well, and we're fortunate, right? Because we talk on the radio. You know, this is a conversation among friends, and we're actually getting out to the masses all over radio land. And so we have that outlet. And I get that some people don't. But, you know, start a podcast. Start a blog. Just yeah. write about that stuff. Throw your eyes at your ideas out there. I mean, Michael's got the right idea, you know, that totally that one-way communication. Then you don't have to deal with all the crazy people that come back and say, but. No.
Explain every aspect right. of what you say. 140 characters, go.
Nope, wrong.
Yeah. I have to say, what happened at Porkfest was kind of interesting. So when I go out of town, where I go to like festivals or something like that, I don't like to communicate a lot like on social media stuff. And I'll turn my phone off. But yeah, Facebook actually disabled my account because they thought my name was fake. And it reduced my stress levels not being allowed.
That's wild. Stick with us, folks. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Freedom Fiends with Michael Dean and some of his weird friends.
Yeah, I was wondering.
And yes, we're broadcasting this into space.
This show survives on donations from fiends like you. We put that money back into our show and Liberty Outreach and donate most our ad space to Liberty organizations that make a difference. We're also a teaching hospital, educating the next generation of Liberty Talkers on the skills needed to keep the radio flame of truth burning into the future. Put your money where your heart is and make a donation of any amount to the Freedom Fiends. Please go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post.
Are you sick of peaceful people being locked away for victimless crimes? Instead of trying to get out of jury duty, consider taking it so you can do the right thing. A single juror with a conscience can send someone home to their family instead of to a jail cell. If there's no victim, how can there be a crime? And if the judge or prosecutor are keeping you in the dark, what are they trying to hide? You can vote your conscience instead of being a pawn of the state. For more information, Google jury nullification or check out the Fully Informed Jury Association at fija.org.
Worms, worms.
Fiends on the radio. Did we ever even introduce ourselves on the show?
Oh.
We're in the last segment of the
We're
last
episode. The disembodied voices coming through the tubes.
So I'm Ben Stone. With me is MK Lords and Chandler St. Pierre. Is that how you say it, St. Pierre, or is it St. How do you say your name, Chandler?
Yeah, it's St. Pierre.
Okay.
St. Pierre.
It's one of those names.
I'm not going to try to put that.
You're not going to say
I'll
it in
Christian
French?
Put that friend. Yeah, no, I'll let Christian put that French accent on it.
That always throws me off. Whenever I see a French name written and then I have to pronounce it, I think, now do I pronounce this like if I'm French or do I, you know, just be a lazy-tongued American that I am and just let it spit out? So I guess if we're going to bring redemption in the third act here, we have to bring up that...
All the old...
Yeah, that humans are problem solvers. And the state is just a problem. It's just government's just one more problem. And it's not something that we need to, you know, it's not doom and gloom. It's not something that, you know, you hear this, Chandler, I think you mentioned this during the break. You hear this constantly from mainstream media that the sky is falling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And you hear so many people in the liberty community doing the same thing, just constantly beating the drum that the sky is about to fall, that the dollar is about to crash, the giant volcano is about to open up and kill us all or whatever. It's just constantly, and you get a little tired of hearing that all the time. And I really think it
burns you out.
It does. It's overload.
It's a bummer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, fear only goes so far. You know, after a while, you get burnt out on that fear and you're just like, whatever. I'm just going to do it.
Yeah.
And you adapt.
And that's really, I think, you know, that's the key, is to not let yourself get overwhelmed. Go into problem-solving skills for yourself on your own level. You know, we can solve the problem of the government. We can solve on an individual level. I've done that to a certain extent in my life by just moving into an RV and moving away from the parts of the government that annoy me. So I don't have a guy telling me to mow my lawn or else he's going to give me a ticket and, you know, trim my tree this way or he's going to give me a ticket. Or you can't park your RV on your own driveway because I'll give you a ticket. I don't have to deal with any of that stuff. I just live my life free. Go ahead, Chandler.
You know, one of the things in my field, one of the things we learn is that you can't look at the big picture when you're working with clients and you're trying to help them overcome their problems, addictions or mental illness, whatever it is. You can't do the big picture solution. You take it in little tiny baby steps every day and you focus on one thing at a time. And I think that applies in the Liberty Mission as well. You know, if we just say we've got to overcome the problem of the state, the state's a lot of different things to a lot of different people. How about you focus on how it affects you directly in your own life, one step at a time, and then you tackle the next.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think even if it's sometimes hard to define freedom, it's one of those things that other people can recognize, even though they may not have a perfect definition for it.
Oh, exactly.
And people will be able to notice it.
Well, think about how many times, like, my parents are a classic example. They're not into this whole crazy anarchist thing like me. But they agree with a lot of individual issues I say, little statements I make.
Right.
So, you know, we're tackling it step by step. And eventually, they may come to embrace the whole. But even if they don't, that's cool. They still have some concept of what freedom is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Worms, man. Worms.
So deep every worms. Little thing is going to be all right. Just think of Three Little Birds by Bob Marley.
There you go. There you go.
And it's really
and
not...
And maybe some Grateful Dead songs, too.
Yeah. And it's really not our responsibility to save the world. It's not, you know, all we have to do. Go back to the paleo dude. So you got this guy, and his whole civilization is facing an ice age. It's not up to him to save the world if he just figures out how to wear an animal's skin and stay warm. It's just one little thing. If we all just do one little thing.
You can't save the world if you can't save yourself, right?
Yeah, exactly.
One little worm at a time.
One little worm.
Worms.
Chandler, MK.
Hey, it's been a great show, guys.
It's been great.
It's been a pleasure.
Hopefully next year I'll be at Porkfest with you guys.
Oh, yes. That'd be sweet.
Got to.